leaving this house," said she, "and Barawa is looking out suitable apartments for him in another. But you, Mademoiselle de Villefort, you who are necessary to Monsieur Noirtier's happiness—" "Me," interrupted Valentine, "I shall not leave my grandfather. That is an understood thing between us. My apartment will be close to his. Now Monsieur de Villefort must either give his consent to this plan, or his refusal. In the first case, I shall leave directly, and in the second, I shall await my majority, which will be completed in about 10 months. Then I shall be free. I shall have an independent fortune, and—"
"And what?"
demanded Morel. "And with my grandfather's consent, I shall fulfill the promise which I have made you." Valentine pronounced these few last words in such a low tone that nothing but Morel's intense interest in what she was saying could have enabled him to hear them. "Have I not explained your wishes, Grandpapa?" said Valentine, addressing Noirtier. "Yes," looked the old man. "Once under my grandfather's roof, Monsieur Morel can visit me in the presence of my good and worthy protector if we still feel that the union we contemplated will be likely to ensure our future comfort and happiness. In that case, I shall expect Monsieur Morel to come and claim me. But alas, I have heard it said that hearts inflamed by obstacles to their desire grow cold in time of security. I trust we shall never find it so in our experience." "Oh," cried Morel, almost tempted to throw himself on his knees before Noirtier and Valentine, and to adore them as two superior beings, "what have I ever done in my life to merit such unbounded happiness?" "Until that time," continued the young girl, in a calm and self-possessed tone of voice, "we will conform to circumstances and be guided by the wishes of our friends, so long as those wishes do not tend finally to separate us. In one word, and I repeat it because it expresses all I wish to convey, we will wait. And I swear to make all the sacrifices which this word imposes, sir," said Morel, "not only with resignation, but with cheerfulness. Therefore," continued Valentine, looking playfully at Maximilian, "no more inconsiderate actions, no more rash projects, for you surely would not wish to compromise the feelings of her who, from this day, regards herself as destined honorably and happily to bear your name." Morel looked obedience to her commands. Noirtier regarded the lovers with a look of ineffable tenderness, whilst Barrois, who had remained in the room in the character of a man privileged to know everything that passed, smiled on the youthful couple as he wiped the perspiration from his bald forehead. "How hot you look, my good Barrois," said Valentine. "Ah, I have been running very fast, mademoiselle. But I must do Monsieur Morel the justice to say that he ran still faster." Noirtier directed their attention to a waiter on which was placed a decanter containing lemonade and a glass. The decanter was nearly full, with the exception of a little which had been already drunk by Monsieur Noirtier. "Come, Barrois," said the young girl, "take some of this lemonade. I see you are coveting a good draught of it." "The fact is, mademoiselle," said Barrois, "I am dying with thirst, and since you are so kind as to offer it me, I cannot say I should at all object to drinking your health in a glass of it. Take some, then, and come back immediately." Barrois took away the waiter, and hardly was he outside the door, which, in his haste, he forgot to shut, than they saw him throw back his head and empty to the very dregs the glass which Valentine had filled. Valentine and Morel were exchanging their adieux in the presence of Noirtier when a ring was heard at the doorbell. It was the signal of a visit. Valentine looked at her watch. "It is past noon," said she, "and today is Saturday. I dare say it is the doctor, Grandpapa." Noirtier looked his conviction that she was right in her supposition. "He will come in here, and Monsieur Morel had better go. Do you not think so, Grandpapa?"
"Yes,"
signed the old man.
"Barrois,"
called Valentine. "Barrois."
I am coming, mademoiselle, replied he.
Barrois will open the door for you, said Valentine, addressing Morel. And now remember one thing, Mr. Officer, that my grandfather commands you not to take any rash or ill-advised step, which would be likely to compromise our happiness.
I promised him to wait, replied Morel, and I will wait.
At this moment, Barrois entered.
Who rang? Asked Valentine.
Dr. D'Avrigny, said Barrois, staggering as if he would fall.
What is the matter, Barrois? Said Valentine.
The old man did not answer, but looked at his master with wild, staring eyes, whilst with his cramped hand he grasped a piece of furniture to enable him to stand upright.
He is going to fall, cried Morel.
The trembling which had attacked Barrois gradually increased. The features of the face became quite altered, and the convulsive movement of the muscles appeared to indicate the approach of a most serious nervous disorder. Noirtier, seeing Barrois in this pitiable condition, showed by his looks all the various emotions of sorrow and sympathy which can animate the heart of man. Barrois made some steps towards his master.
"Ah, sir," said he, "tell me, what is the matter with me? I am suffering, I cannot see. 1,000 fiery darts are piercing my brain. Ah, don't touch me, pray, don't."
By this time, his haggard eyes had the appearance of being ready to start from their sockets. His head fell back, and the lower extremities of the body began to stiffen. Valentine uttered a cry of horror. Morel took her in his arms, as if to defend her from some unknown danger.
"Monsieur D'Avrigny! Monsieur D'Avrigny!" cried she in a stifled voice. "Help! Help!"
Barrois turned round and, with a great effort, stumbled a few steps, then fell at the feet of Noirtier, and resting his hand on the knee of the invalid, exclaimed,
"My master! My good master!"
At this moment, Monsieur de Villefort, attracted by the noise, appeared on the threshold. Morel relaxed his hold on Valentine, and retreating to a distant corner of the room, he remained half hidden behind a curtain. Pale as if he had been gazing on a serpent, he fixed his terrified eye on the agonized sufferer. Noirtier, burning with impatience and terror, was in despair at his utter inability to help his old domestic, whom he regarded more in the light of a friend than a servant. One might trace the terrible conflict which was going on between the living, energetic mind and the inanimate and helpless body by the fearful swelling of the veins of his forehead and the contraction of the muscles round the eye. Barrois, his features convulsed, his eyes suffused with blood, and his head thrown back, was lying at full length, beating the floor with his hands, whilst his legs had become so stiff that they looked as if they would break rather than bend. A slight appearance of foam was visible round the mouth, and he breathed painfully and with extreme difficulty. Villefort seemed stupefied with astonishment and remained gazing intently on the scene before him without uttering a word. He had not seen Morel. After a moment of dumb contemplation, during which his face became pale and his hair seemed to stand on end, he sprang towards the door, crying out,
"Doctor! Doctor! Come instantly! Pray, come!"
"Madame! Madame!" cried Valentine,
calling her stepmother and running upstairs to meet her.
"Come, quick, quick, and bring your bottle of smelling salts with you."
"What is the matter?" said Madame de Villefort in a harsh and constrained tone.
"Oh, come, come!"
"But where is the doctor?" exclaimed Villefort. "Where is he?"
Madame de Villefort now deliberately descended the staircase. In one hand she held her handkerchief, with which she appeared to be wiping her face, and in the other a bottle of English smelling salts. Her first look on entering the room was at Noirtier, whose face, independent of the emotion which such a scene could not fail of producing, proclaimed him to be in possession of his usual health. Her second glance was at the dying man. She turned pale, and her eye passed quickly from the servant and rested on the master. "In the name of heaven, madame," said Vifor, "where is the doctor? He was with you just now. You see, this is a fit of apoplexy, and he might be saved if he could but be bled."
"Has he eaten anything lately?" asked Madame de Vifor, eluding her husband's question.
"Madame," replied Valentine, "he has not even breakfasted. He has been running very fast on an errand with which my grandfather charged him, and when he returned he took nothing but a glass of lemonade."
"Ah," said Madame de Vifor, "why did he not take wine? Lemonade was a very bad thing for him. Grandpapa's bottle of lemonade was standing just by his side. Poor Barrois was very thirsty, and was thankful to drink anything he could find."
Madame de Vifor started. Noirtier looked at her with a glance of the most profound scrutiny.
"He has such a short neck," said she.
"Madame," said de Vifor, "I ask, where is Monsieur d'Avrigny? In God's name, answer me."
"He is with Edouard, who is not quite well," replied Madame de Vifor, no longer being able to avoid answering.
Vifor rushed upstairs to fetch him himself.
"Take this," said Madame de Vifor, giving her smelling bottle to Valentine. "They will, no doubt, bleed him. Therefore I will retire, for I cannot endure the sight of blood."
And she followed her husband upstairs. Morel now emerged from his hiding-place, where he had remained quite unperceived, so great had been the general confusion.
"Go away as quick as you can, Maximilian," said Valentine, "and stay till I send for you. Go."
Morel looked towards Noirtier for permission to retire. The old man, who had preserved all his usual sang-froid, made a sign to him to do so. The young man pressed Valentine's hand to his lips, and then left the house by a back staircase. At the same moment that he quitted the room, Vifor and the doctor entered by an opposite entrance. Barrois was now showing signs of returning consciousness. The crisis seemed past. A low moaning was heard, and he raised himself on one knee. D'Avrigny and Vifor laid him on a couch.
"What do you prescribe, doctor?" demanded Vifor.
"Give me some water and ether. You have some in the house, have you not?"
"Yes."
"Send for some oil of turpentine and tartar emetic." Vifor immediately dispatched a messenger. "And now let everyone retire."
"Must I go too?" asked Valentine timidly.
"Yes, mademoiselle. You especially," replied the doctor abruptly. Valentine looked at Monsieur d'Avrigny with astonishment, kissed her grandfather on the forehead, and left the room. The doctor closed the door after her with a gloomy air.
"Look, look, doctor," said Vifor, "he is quite coming round again. I really do not think, after all, it is anything of consequence."
Monsieur d'Avrigny answered by a melancholy smile.
"How do you feel yourself, Barrois?" asked he.
"A little better, sir." "Will you drink some of this ether and water?"
"I will try. But don't touch me."
"Why not?"
"Because I feel that if you were only to touch me with the tip of your finger, the fit would return."
"Drink." Barrois took the glass, and raising it to his purple lips, took about half of the liquid offered him. "Where do you suffer?" asked the doctor.
"Everywhere. I feel cramp over my whole body."
"Do you find any dazzling sensation before the eyes?"
"Yes."
"Any noise in the ears?"
"Frightful."
"When did you first feel that?"
"Just now."
"Suddenly?"
"Yes, like a clap of thunder."
"Did you feel nothing of it yesterday or the day before?"
"Nothing."
"No drowsiness?"
"None."
"What have you eaten today?"
"I have eaten nothing. I only drank a glass of my master's lemonade, that's all."
And Barrois turned towards Noirtier, who, immovably fixed in his armchair, was contemplating this terrible scene without allowing a word or a movement to escape him. "Where is this lemonade?" asked the doctor eagerly.
"Downstairs, in the decanter."
"Whereabouts downstairs?"
"In the kitchen."
"Shall I go and fetch it, doctor?" inquired Vifor.
"No.
Stay here and try to make Barois drink the rest of this glass of ether and water. I will go myself and fetch the lemonade."
Davrigny bounded towards the door, flew down the back staircase, and almost knocked down Madame de Villefort in his haste, who was herself going down to the kitchen. Davrigny paid no attention to her. Possessed with but one idea, he cleared the last four steps with a bound and rushed into the kitchen, where he saw the decanter, about three parts empty, still standing on the waiter, where it had been left. He darted upon it as an eagle would seize upon its prey. Panting with loss of breath, he returned to the room he had just left. Madame de Villefort was slowly ascending the steps which led to her room.
"Is this the decanter you spoke of?" asked Davrigny.
"Yes, doctor. Is this the same lemonade of which you partook?"
"I believe so. What did it taste like?"
"It had a bitter taste."
The doctor poured some drops of the lemonade into the palm of his hand, put his lips to it, and after having rinsed his mouth as a man does when he is tasting wine, he spat the liquor into the fireplace.
"It is no doubt the same," said he.
"Did you drink some too, Monsieur Noirtier?"
"Yes."
"And did you also discover a bitter taste?"
"Yes."
"Oh, doctor," cried Barois, "the fit is coming on again. Oh, have pity on me."
The doctor flew to his patient.
"That emetic, Vifor, see if it is coming."
Vifor sprang into the passage, exclaiming,
the emetic, is it come yet?"
No one answered. The most profound terror reigned throughout the house.
"If I had anything by means of which I could inflate the lungs," said Davrigny, looking around him, "perhaps I might prevent suffocation. But there is nothing which would do, nothing."
"Oh, sir," cried Barois, "are you going to let me die without help? Oh, I am dying. Oh, save me."
"A pen, a pen," said the doctor.
There was one lying in the table. He endeavoured to introduce it into the mouth of the patient, who, in the midst of his convulsions, was making vain attempts to vomit, but the jaws were so clenched that the pen could not pass them. This second attack was much more violent than the first, and he had slipped from the couch to the ground, where he was writhing in agony. The doctor left him in this paroxysm, knowing that he could do nothing to alleviate it, and going up to Noirtier, said abruptly,
"How do you find yourself?"
"Well?"
"Yes.
Have you any weight on the chest, or does your stomach feel light and comfortable, eh?"
"Yes."
"Then you feel pretty much as you generally do after you have had the dose which I am accustomed to give you every Sunday?"
"Yes."
"Did Barois make your lemonade?"
"Yes."
"Was it you who asked him to drink some of it?"
"No."
"Was it Monsieur de Villefort?"
"No."
"Madame?"
"No."
"It was your granddaughter, then, was it not?"
"Yes."
A groan from Barois, accompanied by a yawn which seemed to crack the very jawbones, attracted the attention of Monsieur Davrigny. He left Monsieur Noirtier and returned to the sick man.
"Barois," said the doctor, "can you speak?"
Barois muttered a few unintelligible words. "Try and make an effort to do so, my good man," said Davrigny. Barois reopened his bloodshot eyes.
"Who made the lemonade?"
"I did."
"Did you bring it to your master directly it was made?"
"No."
"You left it somewhere, then, in the meantime?"
"Yes. I left it in the pantry because I was called away."
"Who brought it into this room, then?"
"Mademoiselle Valentine."
Davrigny struck his forehead with his hand.
"Gracious heaven!" exclaimed he.
"Doctor! Doctor!" cried Barois,
who felt another fit coming on.
"Will they never bring that emetic?" asked the doctor.
"Here is a glass with one already prepared," said Villefort, entering the room. "Who prepared it?"
"The chemist who came here with me."
"Drink it," said the doctor to Barois.
"Impossible, doctor. It is too late. My throat is closing up. I am choking. Oh, my heart. Oh, my head. Oh, what agony. Shall I suffer like this long?"
No. No, friend, replied the doctor. You will soon cease to suffer.
Ah, I understand you, said the unhappy man. My God, have mercy upon me.
And, uttering a fearful cry, Barrois fell back as if he had been struck by lightning. D'Avrigny put his hand to his heart and placed a glass before his lips.
Well, said Villefort,
go to the kitchen and get me some syrup of violets. Villefort went immediately. Do not be alarmed, Monsieur Noirtier, said D'Avrigny. I am going to take my patient into the next room to bleed him. This sort of attack is very frightful to witness. And taking Barrois under the arms, he dragged him into an adjoining room. But almost immediately he returned to fetch the remainder of the lemonade. Noirtier closed his right eye. You want Valentine, do you not? I will tell them to send her to you. Villefort returned, and D'Avrigny met him in the passage.
Well, how is he now? Asked he.
Come in here, said D'Avrigny, and he took him into the chamber where the sick man lay.
Is he still in a fit? Said the procureur du roi.
He is dead. Villefort drew back a few steps and, clasping his hands, exclaimed with real amazement and sympathy,
Dead? And so soon, too?
Yes, it is very soon, said the doctor, looking at the corpse before him. But that ought not to astonish you. Monsieur and Madame de Saint-Marin died as soon. People die very suddenly in your house, Monsieur de Villefort.
What?
Cried the magistrate, with an accent of horror and consternation.
Are you still harping on that terrible idea?
Still, sir. And I shall always do so, replied D'Avrigny, for it has never for one instant ceased to retain possession of my mind. And that you may be quite sure I am not mistaken this time, listen well to what I am going to say, Monsieur de Villefort. The magistrate trembled convulsively. There is a poison which destroys life almost without leaving any perceptible traces. I know it well. I have studied it in all its qualities and in the effect which it produces. I recognize the presence of this poison in the case of poor Barrois, as well as in that of Madame de Saint-Marin. There is a way of detecting its presence. It restores the blue color of litmus paper reddened by an acid, and it turns syrup of violets green. We have no litmus paper, but hark, here they come with the syrup of violets. The doctor was right. Steps were heard in the passage. Monsieur D'Avrigny opened the door and took from the hands of the femme de chambre a cup which contained two or three spoonfuls of the syrup. He then carefully closed the door. Look, said he to the procureur du roi, whose heart beat so loudly that it might almost be heard. Here is in this cup some syrup of violets, and this decanter contains the remainder of the lemonade of which Monsieur Noirtier and Barrois partook. If the lemonade be pure and inoffensive, the syrup will color. If, on the contrary, the lemonade be drugged with poison, the syrup will become green. Look well at it. The doctor then slowly poured some drops of the lemonade from the decanter into the cup, and, in an instant, a kind of light, cloudy sediment began to form at the bottom of the cup. This sediment first took a blue shade, then from the color of sapphire it passed to that of opal, and from opal to emerald. Arrived at this last hue, it changed no more. The result of the experiment left no doubt whatever on the mind. The unfortunate Barrois has been poisoned, said D'Avrigny, and I will maintain this assertion before God and man. Villefort said nothing, but he clasped his hands, opened his haggard eyes, and, overcome with his emotion, sank into a chair. 81. The Accusation. Monsieur de Vrigny soon restored the magistrate to consciousness, who had looked like a second corpse in that chamber of death.
"Oh, death is in my house," cried Villefort.
"Say, rather, crime," replied the doctor.
"Monsieur de Vrigny," cried Villefort, "I cannot tell you all I feel at this moment. Terror, grief, madness."
"Yes," said Monsieur de Vrigny with an imposing calmness. "But I think it is now time to act. I think it is time to stop this torrent of mortality. I can no longer bear to be in possession of these secrets without the hope of seeing the victims and society generally revenged." Villefort cast a gloomy look around him.
"In my house," murmured he, "in my house."
"Come, magistrate," said Monsieur de Vrigny, "show yourself a man. As an interpreter of the law, do honor to your profession by sacrificing your selfish interests to it."
"You make me shudder, doctor. Do you talk of a sacrifice?"
"I do."
"Do you then suspect anyone?"
"I suspect no one." "Death raps at your door. It enters. It goes not blindfolded, but circumspectly from room to room. Well, I follow its course. I track its passage. I adopt the wisdom of the ancients and feel my way, for my friendship for your family and my respect for you are as a twofold bandage over my eyes. Well, oh, speak, speak, doctor. I shall have courage." "Well, sir, you have in your establishment, or in your family, perhaps, one of those frightful phenomena of which each century produces only one. Locasta and Agrippina, living at the same time, were an exception, and proved the determination of Providence to effect the entire ruin of the Roman Empire, sullied by so many crimes. Brunhalt and Fredegonde were the results of the painful struggle of civilization in its infancy, when man was learning to control mind, were it even by an emissary from the realms of darkness. All these women have been, or were, beautiful. The same flower of innocence had flourished, or was still flourishing, on their brow, that is seen on the brow of the culprit in your house." Villefort shrieked, clasped his hands, and looked at the doctor with a supplicating air, but the latter pursued without pity. "Seek whom the crime would profit," says an axiom of jurisprudence.
"Doctor," cried Villefort, "alas, doctor, how often has man's justice been deceived by those fatal words? I know not why, but I feel that this crime..."
"You acknowledge, then, the existence of the crime?"
"Yes, I see too plainly that it does exist. But it seems that it is intended to affect me personally. I fear an attack myself after all these disasters."
"Oh, man," murmured d'Avrigny, "the most selfish of all animals, the most personal of all creatures, who believes the earth turns, the sun shines, and death strikes for him alone, an ant cursing God from the top of a blade of grass. And have those who have lost their lives lost nothing? Monsieur de Saint-Marin, Madame de Saint-Marin, Monsieur Noirtier?"
"How, Monsieur Noirtier?"
"Yes. Think you it was the poor servant's life was coveted?"
"No.
No, like Shakespeare's Polonius, he died for another. It was Noirtier the lemonade was intended for. It is Noirtier, logically speaking, who drank it. The other drank it only by accident, and although Barrois is dead, it was Noirtier whose death was wished for."
"But why did it not kill my father?"
"I told you one evening in the garden, after Madame de Saint-Marin's death, because his system is accustomed to that very poison, and the dose was trifling for him, which would be fatal for another, because no one knows, not even the assassin, that for the last 12 months I have given Monsieur Noirtier brucine for his paralytic affection.
while the assassin is not ignorant, for he has proved it, that brucine is a violent poison.
Pity, pity, murmured Vifor, wringing his hands. Follow the culprit's steps. He first kills Monsieur de Saint-Marin. Oh, doctor, I would swear to it. What I heard of his symptoms agrees too well with what I have seen in the other cases. Vifor ceased to contend. He only groaned. He first kills Monsieur de Saint-Marin, repeated the doctor. Then Madame de Saint-Marin, a double fortune to inherit.
Vifor wiped the perspiration from his forehead. Listen attentively.
Alas, stammered Vifor, I do not lose a single word.
Monsieur Noirtier, resumed Monsieur d'Avrigny, in the same pitiless tone, Monsieur Noirtier had once made his will against you, against your family, in favor of the poor, in fact. Monsieur Noirtier is spared, because nothing is expected from him. But he has no sooner destroyed his first will and made a second than, for fear he should make a third, he is struck down. The will was made the day before yesterday, I believe. You see, there has been no time lost.
Oh, mercy, Monsieur d'Avrigny.
No mercy, sir. The physician has a sacred mission on earth. And to fulfill it, he begins at the source of life and goes down to the mysterious darkness of the tomb. When crime has been committed, and God, doubtless in anger, turns away his face, it is for the physician to bring the culprit to justice.
Have mercy on my child, sir, murmured Vifor.
You see, it is yourself who have first named her. You, her father.
Have pity on Valentine. Listen, it is impossible. I would as willingly accuse myself. Valentine, whose heart is pure as a diamond or a lily.
No pity, Monsieur le Procureur du Roi. The crime is flagrant. Mademoiselle herself packed all the medicines which were sent to Monsieur de Saint-Marin, and Monsieur de Saint-Marin is dead. Mademoiselle de Vifor prepared all the cooling draughts which Madame de Saint-Marin took, and Madame de Saint-Marin is dead. Mademoiselle de Vifor took from the hands of Barrois, who was sent out, the lemonade which Monsieur Noirtier has every morning, and he has escaped only by a miracle. Mademoiselle de Vifor is the culprit. She is the poisoner. Monsieur le Procureur du Roi, I denounce Mademoiselle de Vifor. Do your duty.
Doctor, I resist no longer. I can no longer defend myself. I believe you. But for pity's sake, spare my life, my honor.
Monsieur de Vifor, replied the doctor with increased vehemence, there are occasions when I dispense with all foolish human circumspection. If your daughter had committed only one crime, and I saw her meditating another, I would say, warn her, punish her, let her pass the remainder of her life in a convent, weeping and praying. If she had committed two crimes, I would say, here, Monsieur de Vifor, is a poison that the poisoner is not acquainted with, one that has no known antidote, quick as thought, rapid as lightning, mortal as the thunderbolt. Give her that poison, recommending her soul to God, and save your honor and your life, for it is yours she aims at. And I can picture her approaching your pillow with her hypocritical smiles and her sweet exhortations. Woe to you, Monsieur de Vifor, if you do not strike first. This is what I would say had she only killed two persons. But she has seen three deaths, has contemplated three murdered persons, has knelt by three corpses. To the scaffold with the poisoner, to the scaffold. Do you talk of your honor? Do what I tell you, and immortality awaits you. Vifor fell on his knees.
Listen, said he, I have not the strength of mind you have,
or rather that which you would not have if instead of my daughter Valentine, your daughter Madeleine were concerned.
The doctor turned pale.
Doctor, every son of woman is born to suffer and to die. I am content to suffer and to await death.
Beware, said Monsieur d'Avrigny. It may come slowly. You will see it approach after having struck your father, your wife, perhaps your son. Vifor, suffocating, pressed the doctor's arm.
Listen, cried he. Pity me. Help me. No, my daughter is not guilty. If you drag us both before a tribunal, I will still say, no, my daughter is not guilty. There is no crime in my house. I will not acknowledge a crime in my house, for when crime enters a dwelling, it is like death. It does not come alone. Listen, what does it signify to you if I am murdered? Are you my friend? Are you a man? Have you a heart? No, you are a physician. Well, I tell you, I will not drag my daughter before a tribunal and give her up to the executioner. The bear... idea would kill me, would drive me like a madman to dig my heart out with my fingernails. And if you were mistaken, doctor, if it were not my daughter, if I should come one day pale as a spectre and say to you, assassin, you have killed my child. Hold, if that should happen, although I am a Christian, Monsieur d'Avrigny, I should kill myself.
Well, said the doctor, after a moment's silence. I will wait. Vifor looked at him as if he had doubted his words. Only, continued Monsieur d'Avrigny, with a slow and solemn tone, if anyone falls ill in your house, if you feel yourself attacked, do not send for me, for I will come no more. I will consent to share this dreadful secret with you, but I will not allow shame and remorse to grow and increase in my conscience, as crime and misery will in your house.
Then you abandon me, doctor?
Yes, for I can follow you no farther, and I only stop at the foot of the scaffold. Some further discovery will be made which will bring this dreadful tragedy to a close. Adieu.
I entreat you, doctor.
All the horrors that disturb my thoughts make your house odious and fatal. Adieu, sir.
One word. One single word more, doctor. You go leaving me in all the horror of my situation after increasing it by what you have revealed to me. But what will be reported of the sudden death of this poor old servant?
True, said Monsieur d'Avrigny. We will return. The doctor went out first, followed by Monsieur de Vifor. The terrified servants were on the stairs and in the passage where the doctor would pass. Sir, said d'Avrigny to Vifor, so loud that all might hear, poor Barrois has led too sedentary a life of late. Accustomed formerly to ride on horseback or in the carriage to the four corners of Europe, the monotonous walk round that armchair had killed him. His blood has thickened. He was stout, had a short, thick neck. He was attacked with apoplexy, and I was called in too late. Apropos, added he in a low tone, take care to throw away that cup of syrup of violets in the ashes. The doctor, without shaking hands with Vifor, without adding a word to what he had said, went out amid the tears and lamentations of the whole household. The same evening, all Vifor's servants, who had assembled in the kitchen and had a long consultation, came to tell Madame Vifor they wished to leave. No entreaty, no proposition of increased wages could induce them to remain. To every argument they replied, "We must go, for death is in this house." They all left, in spite of prayers and entreaties, testifying their regret at leaving so good a master and mistress, and especially Mademoiselle Valentine, so good, so kind, and so gentle. Vifor looked at Valentine as they said this. She was in tears, and strange as it was, in spite of the emotions he felt at the sight of these tears, he looked also at Madame de Villefort, and it appeared to him as if a slight gloomy smile had passed over her thin lips, like those meteors which are seen passing inauspiciously between two clouds in a stormy sky. 82. The Room of the Retired Baker. The evening of the day on which the Comte de Morcerf had left Danglars' house with feelings of shame and anger caused by the banker's declining the projected alliance between their two families, Monsieur Andrea Cavalcanti, with curled hair, moustaches in perfect order, and white gloves which fitted admirably, had entered the courtyard of the banker's house in La Chaussée d'Antin. He had not been more than 10 minutes in the drawing-room before he drew Danglars aside into the recess of a bow-window, and, after an ingenious preamble, related to him all his anxieties and cares since his noble father's departure. He acknowledged the extreme kindness which had been shown him by the banker's family, in which he had been received as a son, and where, besides, his warmest affections had found an object on which to centre in Mademoiselle Danglars. Danglars listened with the most profound attention. He had expected this declaration the last 2 or 3 days, and when at last it came, his eyes glistened as much as they had lowered on listening to Morcerf. He would not, however, yield immediately to the young man's request, but made a few conscientious scruples.
"Are you not rather young, Monsieur Andrea, to think of marrying?"
"I think not, sir," replied Monsieur Cavalcanti. "In Italy the nobility generally marry young. Life is so uncertain, we ought to secure happiness while it is within our reach."
"Well, sir," said Danglars, "in case your proposals, which do me honour, are accepted by my wife and daughter, by whom shall the preliminary arrangements be settled? So important a negotiation should, I think, be conducted by the respective fathers of the young people."
"Sir, my father is a man of great foresight and prudence. Imagining I might wish to settle in France, he left me at his departure, together with the papers constituting my identity, a letter promising, if he approved of my choice, 150,000 livres per annum from the day I was married. So far as I can judge, I suppose this to be a quarter of my father's revenue."
"I," said Danglars, "have always intended giving my daughter 500,000 francs as her dowry. She is, besides, my sole heiress."
"All would then be easily arranged if the Baroness and her daughter are willing. We should command an annuity of 175,000 livres. Supposing, also, I should persuade the Marquis to give me my capital, which is not likely, but still is possible, we would place these 2 or 3 millions in your hands, whose talent might make it realize 10%.
"I never give more than 4%, and generally only 3.5%. But to my son-in-law I would give 5, and we would share the profit."
"Very good, father-in-law," said Cavalcanti, yielding to his low-born nature, which would escape sometimes through the aristocratic gloss with which he sought to conceal it. Correcting himself immediately, he said, "Excuse me, sir. Hope alone makes me almost mad. What will not reality do?"
"But," said Danglars, who, on his part, did not perceive how soon the conversation, which was at first disinterested, was turning to a business transaction, "there is, doubtless, a part of your fortune your father could not refuse you."
"Which?" asked the young man.
"That you inherit from your mother."
"Truly, from my mother, Leonora Corsinari.
How much may it amount to?"
"Indeed, sir," said Andrea, "I assure you I have never given the subject a thought, but I suppose it must have been at least 2 millions.
Danglar felt as much overcome with joy as the miser who finds a lost treasure, or as the shipwrecked mariner who feels himself on the solid ground instead of in the abyss which he expected would swallow him up. "Well, sir," said Andrea, bowing to the banker respectfully, "may I hope?"
"You may not only hope," said Danglar, "but consider it a settled thing, if no obstacle arises on your part."
"I am indeed rejoiced," said Andrea.
"But," said Danglars thoughtfully, "how is it that your patron, Monsieur de Monte Cristo, did not make this proposal for you?"
Andrea blushed imperceptibly. "I have just left the Count, sir," said he. "He is, doubtless, a delightful man, but inconceivably singular in his ideas. He esteems me highly. He even told me he had not the slightest doubt that my father would give me the capital instead of the interest of my property. He has promised to use his influence to obtain it for me, but he also declared that he never had taken on himself the responsibility of making proposals for another, and he never would. I must, however, do him the justice to add that he assured me, if ever he had regretted the repugnance he felt to such a step, it was on this occasion, because he thought the projected union would be a happy and suitable one. Besides, if he will do nothing officially, he will answer any questions you propose to him. And now," continued he with one of his most charming smiles, "having finished talking to the father-in-law, I must address myself to the banker."
"And what may you have to say to him?" said Danglars, laughing in his turn.
"That the day after tomorrow I shall have to draw upon you for about 4,000 francs. But the Count, expecting my bachelor's revenue could not suffice for the coming month's outlay, has offered me a draft for 20,000 francs. It bears his signature, as you see, which is all sufficient."
"Bring me a million such as that," said Danglars. "I shall be well pleased," putting the draft in his pocket. "Fix your own hour for tomorrow, and my cashier shall call on you with a check for 80,000 francs.
"At 10 o'clock, then, if you please. I should like it early, as I am going into the country tomorrow."
"Very well, at 10 o'clock. You are still at the Hôtel des Princes?"
"Yes." The following morning, with the banker's usual punctuality, the 80,000 francs were placed in the young man's hands, as he was on the point of starting, having left 200 francs for Caderousse. He went out chiefly to avoid this dangerous enemy, and returned as late as possible in the evening. But scarcely had he stepped out of his carriage when the porter met him cap in hand.
"Sir," said he, "the man has been."
"What man?" said Andrea carelessly, apparently forgetting him whom he but too well recollected, "him to whom your excellency pays that little annuity."
"Oh," said Andrea, "my father's old servant."
"Well, you gave him the 200 francs I had left for him?"
"Yes, your excellency."
Andrea had expressed a wish to be thus addressed.
"But," continued the porter, "he would not take them."
Andrea turned pale, but as it was dark, no one noticed his paleness.
"What? He would not take them?" said he, with slight emotion.
"No, he wished to speak to your excellency. I told him you were gone out, which, after some dispute, he believed, and gave me this letter, which he had brought with him already sealed."
"Give it me," said Andrea, and he read by the light of his carriage lamp.
"You know where I live. I expect you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Andrea examined it carefully to ascertain if the letter had been opened or if any indiscreet eyes had seen its contents, but it was so carefully folded no one could have read it, and the seal was perfect.
"Very well," said he.
"Poor man, he is a worthy creature." He left the porter to ponder on these words, not knowing which most to admire, the master or the servant. "Take out the horses quickly and come up to me," said Andrea to his groom. In 2 seconds the young man had reached his room and burnt Caderousse's letter. The servant entered just as he had finished.
"You are about my height, Peter," said he.
I have that honour, Your Excellency. You had a new livery yesterday?
Yes, sir. I have an engagement with a pretty little girl for this evening, and do not wish to be known. Lend me your livery till tomorrow. I may sleep, perhaps, at an inn.
Peter obeyed. 5 minutes after, Andrea left the hotel completely disguised, took a cabriolet, and ordered the driver to take him to the Cheval Rouge at Pieppes. The next morning, he left that inn as he had left the Hôtel des Princes without being noticed, walked down the Faubourg Saint-Antoine, along the boulevard to Rue Ménilmontant, and, stopping at the door of the third house on the left, looked for someone of whom to make inquiry in the porter's absence.
"Who are you looking for, my fine fellow?" asked the fruiteress on the opposite side.
"Monsieur Payatin, if you please, my good woman," replied Andrea.
"A retired baker?" asked the fruiteress.
"Exactly.
He lives at the end of the yard on the left, on the third story."
Andrea went as she directed him, and on the third floor he found a hare's paw, which, by the hasty ringing of the bell, it was evident he pulled with considerable ill temper. A moment after, Caderousse's face appeared at the grating in the door.
"Ah, you are punctual," said he, as he unbolted the door.
"Confound you and your punctuality," said Andrea, throwing himself into a chair in a manner which implied that he would rather have flung it at the head of his host.
"Come, come, my little fellow, don't be angry. See, I have thought about you. Look at the good breakfast we are going to have. Nothing but what you are fond of."
Andrea, indeed, inhaled the scent of something cooking which was not unwelcome to him, hungry as he was. It was that mixture of fat and garlic peculiar to provincial kitchens of an inferior order, added to that of dried fish, and above all, the pungent smell of musk and cloves. These odours escaped from two deep dishes which were covered and placed on a stove, and from a copper pan placed in an old iron pot. In an adjoining room, Andrea saw also a tolerably clean table prepared for two bottles of wine sealed, the one with green, the other with yellow, a considerable portion of brandy in a decanter, and a measure of fruit in a cabbage leaf, cleverly arranged on an earthenware plate.
"What do you think of it, my little fellow?" said Caderousse. "Aye, that smells good. You know I used to be a good cook. Do you recollect how you used to lick your fingers? You were among the first who tasted any of my dishes, and I think you relished them tolerably."
While speaking, Caderousse went on peeling a fresh supply of onions.
"But," said Andrea ill-temperedly, "pardieu, if it was only to breakfast with you, you disturbed me. I wish the devil had taken you."
"My boy," said Caderousse sententiously, "one can talk while eating. And then, you ungrateful being, are you not pleased to see an old friend? I am weeping with joy."
"Hold your tongue, hypocrite," said Andrea.
"You love me."
"Yes, I do, or may the devil take me."
"I know it is a weakness," said Caderousse, "but it overpowers me. And yet it has not prevented your sending for me to play me some trick."
"Come," said Caderousse, wiping his large knife on his apron,
"if I did not like you, do you think I should endure the wretched life you lead me? Think for a moment. You have your servant's clothes on. You therefore keep a servant. I have none, and am obliged to prepare my own meals. You abuse my cookery because you dine at the table d'hôte of the Hôtel des Princes or the Café de Paris. Well, I too could keep a servant. I too could have a tilbury. I too could dine where I like. But why do I not? Because I would not annoy my little Benedetto. Come, just acknowledge that I could, eh?"
This address was accompanied by a look which it was by no means difficult to understand.
"Well," said Andrea, "admitting your love, why do you want me to breakfast with you?"
"That I may have the pleasure of seeing you, my little fellow.
What is the use of seeing me after we have made all our arrangements?
Ay, dear friend, said Caderousse, are wills ever made without codicils? But you first came to breakfast, did you not? Well, sit down and let us begin with these pilchards and this fresh butter which I have put on some vine leaves to please you, wicked one. Oh, yes, you look at my room, my four straw chairs, my images, 3 francs each. But what do you expect? This is not the Hôtel des Princes.
Come, you are growing discontented. You are no longer happy. You, who only wish to appear a retired baker. Caderousse sighed. Well, what have you to say? You have seen your dream realized.
I can still say it is a dream. A retired baker, my poor Benedetto, is rich. He has an annuity.
Well, you have an annuity.
I have, yes, since I bring you your 200 francs.
Caderousse shrugged up his shoulders.
It is humiliating, said he, thus to receive money given grudgingly, an uncertain supply which may soon fail. You see, I am obliged to economize in case your prosperity should cease. Well, my friend, fortune is inconstant, as said the chaplain of regiment. I know your prosperity is great, rascal. You are to marry the daughter of Danglars.
What? Of Danglars?
Yes, to be sure. Must I say Baron Danglars?
I might as well say Count Benedetto.
He was an old friend of mine, and if he had not so bad a memory, he ought to invite me to your wedding, seeing he came to mine. Yes. Yes, to mine. Forsooth, he was not so proud then. He was an underclerk to the good Monsieur Morel. I have dined many times with him and the Comte de Morcerf. So you see, I have some high connections, and were I to cultivate them a little, we might meet in the same drawing rooms. Come. Your jealousy represents everything to you in the wrong light. That is all very fine, my Benedetto, but I know what I am saying. Perhaps I may one day put on my best coat, and presenting myself at the great gate, introduce myself. Meanwhile, let us sit down and eat.
Caderousse set the example and attacked the breakfast with good appetite, praising each dish he set before his visitor. The latter seemed to have resigned himself. He drew the corks and partook largely of the fish with the garlic and fat.
"Ah, compère," said Caderousse, "you are getting on better terms with your old landlord."
"Faith, yes," replied Andrea, whose hunger prevailed over every other feeling.
"So you like it, you rogue.
So much that I wonder how a man who can cook thus can complain of hard living."
"Do you see," said Caderousse, "all my happiness is marred by one thought."
"What is that?"
"That I am dependent on another. I, who have always gained my own livelihood honestly."
"Do not let that disturb you. I have enough for two."
"No, truly. You may believe me if you will. At the end of every month I am tormented by remorse."
"Good Caderousse."
"So much so that yesterday I would not take the 200 francs.
"Yes, you wished to speak to me. But was it indeed remorse, tell me?"
"True remorse. And besides, an idea had struck me."
Andrea shuddered. He always did so at Caderousse's ideas.
"It is miserable, do you see, always to wait till the end of the month."
"Oh," said Andrea, philosophically, determined to watch his companion narrowly, "does not life pass in waiting? Do I, for instance, fare better? Well,
I wait patiently, do I not?
Yes, because instead of expecting 200 wretched francs, you expect 5 or 6,000, perhaps 10, perhaps even 12. For you take care not to let anyone know the utmost. Down there you always had little presents and Christmas boxes which you tried to hide from your poor friend Caderousse. Fortunately, he is a